Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Hope everyone's having a good day today, as much as is possible in the times of this terrible pandemic. But at least it's sunny, or at least it is here. We're having a couple of days of sunshine after lots and lots of rain, which is quite nice. It's probably the hottest day of the year here today. So we've slogged up the hill quite early to keep out of the worst of the heat. So we can, on our normal podcasting route in the hill, so we can do our next episode on in the Tao Te Ching series. So here we go, this is chapter 39, so let's have a read through and then have a little bit of a chat of what we think about this one.
From its first days, the universe came from the One. The heavens are one and clear and round because of it. The earth is one and is its firm infused foundation. The spirit force is one with all it brings into being. The valley is a oneness, and so it flows and renews all things. Everything is one, every living thing is one, and alive. Kings and lords are one in a kingdom that is one, and they can only rule because of the One. If heaven wasn't clear, then the sky would fall down. If the earth cannot be peaceful, it will tear itself apart. If the spirit cannot bless, then no one will believe in it. If the valley can't rebirth, then the valley will run dry. If life can't be itself, then life will be nothing. And if the king is nothing, then the world will be at war. Everything has both yin and yang in it. And from their rise and fall coupling comes new life. The highest authority needs the basement as its base, and the depths are the foundation of the heights. That is why rulers call themselves lonely, like souls in a wilderness who have no home. And in doing so, don't they see, then, that their roots lie with the people? To see yourself as extraordinary is to stand out like jade among ordinary stones. But what people ignore, the lonely and the worthless, is the rock a true leader finds himself on. You see, you win by losing, and you lose by succeeding.
So there's a lot of interesting things in this one, with some strong echoes from the last one we did, which is one of my favourite ones so far. Yeah. So where should we begin with this one then?
I think the beginning might be a good place.
So start at the beginning, folks, always a good place.
Well, it's quite involved this time, and a verbose fell out, so, and therefore fairly tricky to comment upon. But nevertheless, we've got a pattern that we keep seeing again and again. There's a cosmic bit, a cosmological, metaphysical statement, assertion about the nature of things in the large. A very big picture. He's a big picture fellow. And then he relates it to politics, rulership, kings, lords, etc. And so this pattern is repeating itself in this chapter 39. As far as the cosmology goes, Lao Tzu's giving us what I call a big dose of oneness talk. You know, everything originates in the One. And most of this type of thought starts out with an account of origins, particularly religious thought. We're all familiar with Genesis in the West, you know, God created the heavens and the earth in 7 days, out of nothing. Or darkness was upon the waters of the deep, and then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And this kind of formative moment. So similarly, Lao Tzu's got an origins account. He just said everything comes out of the One. And he uses, our translator has given that a capital O, just to sort of underscore the cosmic significance. Capital letters are great for that. By the same token, you have to watch out for them. And he says the heavens are one. This is quite interesting. He says the heavens are round. It's like existence is round. It's a very ancient idea. And even a modern sensibility can resonate with a circle. The sense of completeness you get with a circle, like its line is infinite. It's got no beginning and no end. And it has this enclosure or an embrace that you can easily use to symbolise everything. And so that quirky little phrase actually is a very ancient way of thinking that you can find all over the world. The earth is one, and the spirit force is one, with all it brings into being. So he's got these other categories. He's got spirit as some kind of creative principle. He's got earth as the immediate habitat of human beings, with its earthiness, with its productivity, with its right-in-your-faceness, if I can call it that. And then there's, in the second paragraph, there's an account of disintegration. If heaven wasn't clear, then the sky would fall down. If the earth cannot be peaceful, it will tear itself apart. Kind of true enough. Certainly that second part, we know it to be true. You know, that peace is a very great good in human societies, but we've seldom had it. Somebody calculated you can count the number of peaceful days since the birth of Christ on one hand in the world. The world is constantly at war, you know. Well, it's obvious if we can't kind of get the peace shit together that there's going to be squabbles and wars and turmoil breaking out everywhere. We know this to be true. Just have a little flip the news on, have a little skirt around YouTube, whatever, you'll see that this is the case. So he's talking about disintegration. If the spirit cannot bless, no one will believe in it. So there'll be no sort of productivity. You know, if we're not animated by the force of spirit, the spirit being here like some kind of like animating force, you would have a population of people with no go in them at all, you know, lethargic and nihilistically passive. If the valley can't rebirth, then the valley will run dry. This image of the valley is rather nice. The valley is a low place where waters collect in the valley and then can flow out. And there's like this unifying. It unifies the streams into a single river, a valley. So it uses the metaphor of valley to bring that unifying idea into play. And it gives us a nice image of oneness, the way it collects, the way it holds everything. Now, there is a paradox in oneness talk. Now bear in mind that oneness talk, again, is pretty well universal, particularly in ancient times. You find it in all parts of the world. You find it in Neoplatonism. You find it in the ancient Greece. Parmenides was a oneness talk. And, of course, all the Advaita stuff, the whole notion that everything is one. But what usually happens when people start talking about everything being one is they start saying, if we lose the one, if we don't orientate ourselves with the one, then everything goes to shit individually and collectively. And my reply to that is, well, what kind of a one is it that you can depart from? If you can depart from the one, if you can find a boundary to it that you can cross over in order to deviate from it and be sinful, how can it be the one? Because now you've got two. The minute any act of criticism creates two in the one. And I have to say, a lot of oneness talk is very glib and falls prey to this paradox pretty quickly. But people like to sort of gossip about oneness. And, of course, you can feel very vividly that the whole of existence is one, yourself included, and you are imbricated and enmeshed within it all. And assiduous meditation can produce these experiences, as can psychedelic drugs and so forth. So, yeah, there's a paradox, and one has to be very careful with oneness talk. And it looks like here that Lao Tzu has fallen into that paradox. He's talking about how lovely everything is when it's one and it all works nice. When the kings and lords are one with each other and they're not a sharing power that the kingdom runs along nicely. But then he's saying, oh, the sky's going to fall down if heaven isn't clear, and if the earth's not peaceful, it will tear itself apart. These are like deviations from the one, apparently. And you think, well, Lao Tzu, one of the smartest blokes to walk the planet, and he's falling into this extremely obvious but very common pratfall. But then in the third paragraph, which is very short, you can see that actually that's not what's happening here. He says, everything has both yin and yang in it, and from their rise and fall coupling comes new life. And actually the disintegration is also a part of the one. We have forces of disintegration in which everything falls apart, including human societies, including our own bodies, including our own psyches and our own collectivities. And you have at times, historically, phases of integration when humanity finds itself very, very creative and productive of good things for the people. And this is what he means here, and the talk about the disintegration and everything going to shit isn't a deviation from what oneness. So Lao Tzu's oneness talk actually is vindicated by this last paragraph here. Now this resonates, I think, deeply with our current situation, and from the interplay of integration and disintegration, yin and yang, rise and fall, light and dark, night and day. He's saying that from that interaction, those forces, of course, are in constant interaction in this world picture. From that interaction comes new life. And I'm reminded of W.B. Yeats, the falconer, I don't know what the title I think is, yeah. The centre cannot hold, falconer cannot hear the falconer. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Just this idea of ever turning in the widening Gaia. You see how it starts, doesn't it? The falcon cannot hear the falconer. So everything falls apart. Centrifugal force smashes everything apart. And he was talking, obviously, in the early part of the 20th century, and where some of the forces of disintegration were abundantly evident. But this makes me think of that. It makes me think of 1929 stock market crash, Wall Street. 1933 New Deal, start building it all again. And W.B. Yeats in that poem makes the point that the people whose task it is to rebuild everything find themselves full of life and vigour and the spirit and joyous because of the creativity that's now open to them. It says, those that build anew again are gay. This is what Lao Tzu means here, and he says, and from their rise and fall coupling comes new life. And we could be at a turning point like that now. I think there's a lot of people like us who are hankering to kind of roll their sleeves up and get building the new thing.
I definitely am.
And fuck preserving this old thing. Carrying on, the highest authority needs the basement as its base and the depths of the foundation of the heights. This is again this mutual dependent of opposites. That is why rulers call themselves lonely, like souls in a wilderness who have no home. And in doing so, don't they see then that their roots lie with the people? Well, you know, the base and the heights actually depend on each other. Similarly, a good ruler, a good political centre, takes notice of the people. This is what he says. I mean, we've already got a little bit of a hint that he thinks that power sharing is like a good idea, that monarchs are probably on their own, not such great ideas, too much power concentrated in few hands. Now, obviously, he's speaking at a historical juncture where there's no democracy, where the ordinary people are not educated and are probably quite poor and all the rest of it. Is still in the first part that we've just gone over, talks about lords and the king's kind of power sharing. But now he's actually talking about the dependence of a ruler, somebody who would wield political power on a grassroots base. Lao Tzu, 2,500 years ago. Do they not see that their roots lie with the people? Well, the Parliamentary Labour Party, the right wing of it at least, do not see that. They don't see it. And I personally can't see the chance to use this opportunity brought about by disintegration of our world on all kinds of levels, economic, public health, culture, finance, money, political organisation, all fucking crumbling apart. Creating an opportunity to have the joy of building again and building it better and building it fresher and building it so our people can flourish. I don't see that opportunity being taken up and amounting to anything without a huge global grassroots movement, radical movement that wants the project and is willing and able to undertake the project of rebuilding. And I think this must involve networks of the networks. It will have to be a broad church, it'll have to be some kind of a coalition, it'll have to be able to work with differences in emphasis. But I see no reason why Black Lives Matter can't work with Extinction Rebellion, can't work with trade unions and mobilise people, get them on the streets, get people taking targeted strikes if necessary, and actually showing the system who actually at the end of the day really holds the power and who really creates the wealth. And Lao Tzu's just got a little whiff of that there. But the Parliamentary Labour Party call any grassroots idea student politics. So they've got their insult name for it, student politics. They say, we want to be a political party and not a protest movement. But I'm saying that nothing will come of simply capturing the state with all of its permanent institutional features which enable the current pattern of dominance and disintegration to persist. And I know this is the case because I had a long correspondence with a former MP who spent like 50 pages making that very, very point in a letter. You know, the guy's a lawyer, so he can't express himself. But it's wrong. I mean, I'm with Chomsky on this, you know. We need a mass movement. Then there will be some change. Then we will be able to take up the opportunity and be gay because we're building it again. And it's gay in a kind of old-fashioned sense. So he goes on, to see yourself as extraordinary is to stand out like jade among ordinary stones. But what people ignore, the lonely and the worthless, is the rock a true leader finds himself on. Now we had this theme last time, didn't we? That somebody with true leadership qualities doesn't really stand up and beat the breast and tell the world how great they are. Like some of our strong men politicians who have risen off the back of the disintegration that's and the fragmentatory forces which are currently dictating the unfolding of world history. For Lao Tzu, it's somebody who isn't like a glaring piece of jade on a pile of ordinary little grey pebbles. And somebody who's just down there with the pebbles, down there with the people, ordinary, and without that kind of show. And there are very, very few people of that ilk in politics. And why would somebody like that go into politics? So yeah, he's been political again. Starts off cosmic, goes political. Anyway, he finishes it off. You see, you win by losing, and you lose by succeeding. It's slightly elliptical. But you can see the point. In fact, there is an English proverb, isn't there? Nothing fails like success. It seems to me that the whole boo hurrah of our politics, you know, you win or you lose, of our politics, the whole kind of football game ethic of it is really misplaced. Somebody like Jeremy Corbyn lost two elections, got vilified by his party, was having an enormous popular base, especially for this country where there's a lot of political apathy. So you'd say he's a failure, he failed. It's all over Twitter and Facebook. Jeremy Corbyn's a failure, and will he fuck off now and let somebody professional have a go? You know, he was a student politics waller. He thought you could do politics like a protest movement. And so there's all this vilification falling on him, even though there still are many people who see the worth of the man and deeply appreciate him. But in a sense, he succeeded because he put this agenda of the people, of the people being the ones who will be able to grasp and build upon the opportunity that we now have, as everything falls apart in semi-catastrophe or even in catastrophe. He's put the idea on the map. It's a talking point. People are thinking about it. Young people are behind it. It's got a way to go yet to gain some momentum. We don't really know how to kind of coordinate a global grassroots movement, and it needs to be global, otherwise the earth goes down the tube. If Wales gets carbon neutral, it makes no jot of a difference if China doesn't. You know, it has to be global. But it's getting momentum, it's gaining momentum. And we'll be gay when we grasp it. We'll be joyous when we grasp it and we're building. And a generation will work its fingers to the bone. Or not. You know, it's here in Lao Tzu. 2,500 years ago, you start off cosmic oneness. Well, of course, oneness is true. Of course, because there has to be there is a whole of everything. And you can intuit how you are connected with that. Oneness thinking, as I said, is dangerous and very, very prone to misunderstanding and open to destructive paradoxes. But at the same time, there is a whole of everything. Of course there is. And there is a way of thinking in which you think about relationships instead of things. You think about processes and dynamics instead of just like the universe being like a set of discrete things, well, ultimately atoms, little hard, immutable atoms, Democritus. But you don't think in terms of things, you think in terms of processes interacting with other processes to form another bigger process. You see, in that way, you know you're connected. You know you are in the oneness. Your breath tells you you're in the oneness. You can't breathe without the atmosphere. You can't survive without eating food, which comes out of the earth. You can't survive without being able to excrete what waste product, which the earth processes. And if the earth can't process them, we poison ourselves. There's a whole kind of integration like that, and of course our integration in society, as we're now discovering, our reliance on supply chains, our reliance on key workers, people deemed unskilled and of low status, who actually keeping the whole thing ticking over. People have stacked shelves in shops and supermarkets. Bus drivers, you know. this oneness talk isn't empty. It's full of paradoxes, but it's not empty. And he's pointing out that when you embrace the oneness talk, you can kind of discover that there's integration and disintegration. That there's pulling together and creation, but there's also like fragmentation. But he's also telling us that there are opportunities in that, in the moment of crisis where we turn in from one to the other. And it takes people, ordinary people, to grasp them, and it takes leaders that are sustained in their leadership by people, and not by force, or not by having command of a violent instrument, a police force or an invading army or an occupying army, but by the enthusiasm and creative impetus of the people. It's all in there, in that chapter. Which is quite good.
Yeah.
So I find myself to be backward looking and therefore a conservative, in the sense that I think Lao Tzu might have something to say to us, whilst at the same time wanting power to the people, make knowledge great again, and an understanding that the world is connected and we are all connected to each other. We are not lone strangers, as Mrs. Thatcher wanted to tell us. And this has been the dogma for 40 years. It's why somebody will get their knickers in a twist about wearing a mask, as though that was the ultimate piece of government demagoguery. When actually they do far worse fucking things, the government as we have it now.
Yeah.
And that's neither here nor there, and it might save some lives. But I've been told that there's no such thing as society, there's only individuals. Your freedom is all that matters, inverted commas. I'm going to say to them, well, just whip your kit off and insist on walking down the high street with nothing on and see how long you last, yeah. You know. And insist on it, just keep insisting on it. Anyway, society does have certain demands on us, and I say that. I like to do my own thing, totally. But I will say that society can make demands on us. And we should ask in return of society that it creates the conditions in which we can maximise our freedom and our ability to self-actualise. But you can't do that without an understanding of how you're connected with other people. It doesn't happen in isolation. It can't happen in that sort of isolation. So we've been sold a fallacy for 40 years, which has become the dogma. And a little bit of oneness insight kind of knocks it on the head, a bit of that serious meditation, you know, or a bit of a powerful psychedelic on the top of a mountain somewhere can disabuse you of the Thatcherite nonsense very efficiently. Not that I'm trying to encourage anybody to do anything illegal.
But just a little note on the end there, where it says... something I want to mention, just going back into the text, where it's sort of basically saying that the authorities and the kings and the rulers need to be in touch with the people and listening to the will of the people. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now, and we've seen it in a very... very obviously here in Britain, the will of the people is now easily manufactured, and I know it always has been, but there is no way for the people and the will of the people to rise up and make positive changes in the world if their desires are manufactured only to serve the 1%, for instance.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, we've just had Brexit.
Or
about to have the real Brexit, as it were. But the referendum itself was entirely manufactured. And then the Tories, calling themselves the People's Party, and how much they love democracy, even though they're doing everything they can to destroy it, have said that they are... bringing us into the most destructive, hard Brexit possible because they are honouring the will of the people. They're using that to destroy the very people who voted for Brexit.
Yeah.
So this is a very big problem.
Yeah, it is.
I'm not really quite sure how we're going to get around it, but listening to the will of the people isn't really going to help if the will of the people is just false.
What I'm talking about, and what I think Lao Tzu's talking about, or at least giving us some kind of a hint that we can use in our current situation, is grassroots movement, grassroots popular movement, like the movement that brought about Vouch for Women, and the movement that brought about civil rights in America. Mass movements involving millions of people getting on the streets and doing stuff. This is rather different from a contrived referendum. And you do raise a point that's absolutely vital. It could be a central point that needs addressing in the times which we're now entering into the phase of development or change that we're now entering. And the point is that democracy isn't really true, isn't possible even, without an educated electorate. And of course that...
Yes, how can people vote on anything if they don't actually know what's going on or what the facts of the matter actually are?
Well, if you go back over our podcast, you'll hear me say 3,000 or 4,000 times. a lot of times, you'll hear me say that who controls information controls the world.
Absolutely.
And you'll hear me say that...
And that's why the Tories are voting to do so much of their horrible and awful things in secret.
Yeah, and they're doing them under the cover of the way the pandemic, of course, has taken up all of the oxygen of publicity. I mean, we have many, many problems around getting the information out there. But the great thing about a grassroots movement is that's what it would be. It would be a network of networks which would exchange not only mutual support and love, but they would also exchange information directly, peer-to-peer, not through Murdoch's fascist press as a mediator, not through the BBC's establishment propaganda role, but directly, peer-to-peer, here's what's happening. Here is a film of our meeting. This is what was said. This is a strategy that we tried and it worked very well. The government capitulated on this point, etc. That's what I'm saying. That's why the people, as well as being the obstacle, are also like the only hope.
Yeah.
So it means changing, or what does it say? You know, when he who builds the world anew experiences the ecstasy of life. We're at a point where we have to build the world anew, and we will experience the ecstasy. Like that will be what will drive us on. It will be a festival. It will be a carnivalesque. And a big part of that building will be building the new media which are reliable, the new media which rely on peer-to-peer sharing of the information that we've got, of true, real information that we've got. Maybe the means of putting in safeguards in that so that we can, in fact, distinguish bollocks from good stuff, reliable information. We can create some criteria and assert some criteria for reliability that are themselves reliable. This is all the building that needs doing. And I say, you can't have a democracy without an educated electorate. That brings into question the whole nature of education, you know, and an education that's narrowly state run and inculcates ideas very forcibly into young people as a part of the socialisation of young human beings that serve the interests of the oligarchy only. And of course we see education used for this purpose all over the place. Plato was all for it. So there's a whole big, huge question around that. Lao Tzu, in his wonderful, you know, warring states simplicity and his big broad brush stroke thing, doesn't deal with this, and he can't deal with this. And it's not a uniquely modern problem though. The fact is young human beings are socialised. What happens there? How does that work? How should it work? These are the huge philosophical problems. And these tell us that philosophers and people who can think critically have got an enormous role to play in all of this. And there is, of course, an idea that they haven't. You hear Michael Gove say, well, we don't need experts. Well, of course not. You don't want people who know how, with very, very refined thinking skills, untangling this stuff. For a start, just for starters. So, the point you bring up, to me, emphasises the immensity of the task that faces us as a species, you know. We might not pull it off. But I think I've got we have a bit of an idea of at least some of the necessary features of a programme that's at least got a little bit of hope attached to it.
Well, I hope everyone found that interesting. We're going to carry on with our walk down the hill now, get down into the very busy town. I think probably everyone in Britain is here in Barmouth today. And nearly all of them are on the beach because we can see the beach from where we're standing now, high up above. Anyway, we'll speak to you soon, folks.
Yeah. Remember, make knowledge great again. Lots of love. Dabochi.